From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is in Atlanta today for the RX Drug Abuse and Heroin Summit with doctors, addiction experts, state officials, a day after federal prosecutors brought the first criminal charges against a drug distributor. New York's Rochester Drug Cooperative has agreed to pay a $20 million fine. Yesterday, the company was charged with a scheme to distribute high volumes of oxycodone, fentanyl, and other addictive opioids to pharmacies, knowing they'd be sold to people with no medical need for them. Stephen Dudley is an addictionologist and addiction psychiatrist at Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta. Dr. Dudley, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with some of the other legal aspects of the drug crisis right now. Other trials going on, a huge bundled one in Ohio. One lawsuit alleges that McKesson Corp., another distributor, shipped 3 million pills to one West Virginia pharmacy over 10 months in a town with 4,000 people. So obviously other people are coming in because they know they can get drugs there. Do you hope that the distributor role is a topic in this conference?
Well, I definitely hope it will be a topic in this conference. I think, you know, until there are, you know, big penalties and substantial penalties for the distributors, we're going to continue to have a problem because we're going to continue to have easier access and thus higher overdoses and greater fatality rates.
Not just easier access, but what we're seeing from some of these lawsuits is accusations that, you know, the families behind, for instance, Purdue Pharmacy, the Sackler family, which is one of the richest in the country, which has reportedly made over $4 billion in opioid profits in a little over 10 years. When you are seeing these, what are you as a psychiatrist and someone who treats people with these often fatal addictions, what are you thinking?
Well, you know, it's completely unethical, first of all. You know, but again, what I would say is they have a vested interest, secondary and subsequent to profits received by trying to market their products to a greater degree. However, I think when the risks become greater than the benefits, that being greater penalties and, you know, just greater litigation in response to their profits, that's what's going to change things.
Yeah.
However, they have no interest really to stop doing what they're doing because they're making profits without penalty.
How about the doctors who were seduced by some of these companies with dinners, with other incentives?
You know, the drug industry and pharmaceutical reps certainly have enticed doctors. And I would say, I mean, tricked is a great word, you know, kind of fooled doctors into thinking that these medications were safer than in fact they actually were. And, you know, they actually can be deadly often. So, but here at Emory University, we don't even allow pharm reps for that exact reason, because sometimes, you know, they can be unethical and can, like you said, seduce and entice practitioners into using medications that aren't safe, aren't efficacious.
Well, do you think there is a point now where maybe this should be part of a conference like this? Doctors, you know, maybe who feel that they were tricked and seduced by dealers or coached in how to avoid that?
Oh, no question. And I think, you know, we're in the works in doing that now. I think that's one reason why Emory University doesn't allow pharmaceutical reps, at least, you know, in the psychiatric venue here. So, you know, we're already doing that. But I definitely think that should be part of the conference today, no question about it, because at the end of the day, it's not the pharmaceutical companies or the reps who are prescribing these medications. Yeah. It's the doctors who are either prescribing them or not.
Well, and President Trump is visiting the conference today. Past presidents have also been to the summit. President Trump has called the opioid crisis a public health emergency. He's called for harsher penalties for drug traffickers, including the death penalty. We've heard from opioid addicts who've said, well, don't forget that often the dealer started as and is still a user. Your thoughts on, you know, how to penalize people lower down on the distribution chain?
Well, I definitely believe that there should be harsh penalties for distributors and drug traffickers. However, I agree with you, you know, for people who have the disease of opioid use disorder or dependence or addiction, I think there should be more mitigating and extenuating circumstances, you know, even if they are traffickers, because it is a disease. And sometimes addicts will sell to provide for their habit, no question. But, you know, I think unless you can be proven to having the disease or addiction, that there should be harsher penalties. But for actual patients, there should be mitigating and extenuating circumstances where the penalties would not be quite as harsh, particularly quite as harsh as death.
As somebody who studies addictions and treats people with them, what do you think will work?
Well, I would like expanded access to treatment. Particularly, you know, we use a lot of buprenorphine in my clinic. And right now, you need a special license and, you know, just to be able to prescribe it. And even with the license, you have a quota where you can only have, you can only take on 100 patients. And under special circumstances, you can only see 275 patients to prescribe them buprenorphine. I think just easier access and more access to substance abuse treatment, I think that would help tremendously. And just giving incentives, you know, for providers to be able to provide the requisite medications to help those suffering from the disease of opioid use disorder, particularly buprenorphine. It can help addicts as far as, you know, their disease, you know, it can decrease their cravings. But it's a medication that's so highly regulated, so few doctors are, you know, they're just not able to prescribe it.
That's Stephen Dudley, addictionologist and addiction psychiatrist at Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta, which is hosting the RX Drug Abuse and Heroin Summit. Dr. Dudley, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, more now on the treatment side of the story. Last year, more than 100 people in Denver died of an opioid overdose. Officials responded by offering drug users there a fast track to treatment. John Daly from Colorado Public Radio reports.
Veronica Oberg can easily name a pair of turning points in her life. 6 years ago, she was living and working in Salt Lake City.
I got into a car accident. I was sitting at a red light and got rear-ended by two vehicles, and I broke my back or herniated it in five places.
Oberg, who's now 36, soon got addicted to opioid painkillers.
The doctor that I went to had me on Dilaudid, Soma, Xanax, Oxycodone.
Later, she began doing clerical work for the same doctor, but he got busted for running a pill mill. She ended up unemployed and turned to the black market to treat her pain.
I lost everything in a matter of 2 months after starting heroin.
Heroin addiction sent her into a tailspin. She bounced around the U.S. and ended up living on the streets of Denver. Then, on Halloween last year, turning point number two, she overdosed in a bathroom at the local library. Paramedics used the overdose reversal drug naloxone to bring her back. They took Oberg to the ER at Denver Health.
It saved my life.
That's because the hospital was able to do something for Oberg they couldn't just a few months earlier. Now they could treat her for the overdose in the ER and start her medically assisted drug treatment immediately in a new clinic just down the hall.
Today we are here to officially kick off the new space for the treatment on demand services.
A new Denver Mayor Michael Hancock took a tour recently. Before this, a patient like Oberg coming to the ER having overdosed or in withdrawal would get treated for their most serious symptoms, then get a referral to a drug treatment clinic at another location. Jennifer Nagger with Denver Health says that process could take as long as 3 weeks.
I think most would slip through the cracks. I mean, they were big cracks.
Nagger, a licensed social worker, helps run the Modest Clinic, which has several patient spaces with treatment chairs and privacy curtains. A therapist encourages patients to enroll on the spot in drug treatment. Nagger says then they can get psychotherapy and medications like buprenorphine that are used to treat substance use disorders.
If they're in withdrawal, they can start medication same day. We're paged, and within an hour, one of the behavioral health providers, one of the licensed therapists, presents, meets with the patient, and connects them to next day care.
Last year, Denver Health's emergency department treated more than 900 people who had overdosed or were in withdrawal. Dr. Scott Simpson, medical director for the hospital's psychiatric emergency services, says since December, the new pilot program has already treated well over 100 patients. Still, he says, treating addiction is tricky.
So at the heart of the disease of addiction is ambivalence. People struggle with whether or not they want to be sober, whether they want to keep using.
Having services right there after an overdose helps change that equation for patients. It makes them more likely to follow through and try to get clean. Simpson says with the new program, patients are showing up for treatment next day at a much higher rate than before. 76% of the patients are coming back the next day.
When people begin even contemplating a change, we need to be ready to catch them and help them make that change.
Denver is committing $430,000 this year for on-call therapists to catch patients ready for the change.
Having a hospital here to help when you overdose. Mm-hmm. I overdosed and I don't even know who found me when it happened.
Back at the Treatment on Demand clinic, Veronica Oberg marvels at how far she's come.
I think it's awesome. Like, I'm looking around in this room and they're making it comfortable and the people here seem to care. And when you're an addict on the street, nobody cares. You just feel alone and you feel like...
Oberg says she's still in treatment and has now been sober more than 100 days.
I'm clean now. I mean, it amazes me. I'm happy.
Oberg is now looking to line up housing and trying to find a job. And she says it all happened because she could get help right when she was ready. For Here and Now, I'm John Daly.
The Trump administration upped the pressure on Iran this week, saying to countries that have been buying oil from Iran that they will from now on be penalized by the U.S. for doing so. Iran, in turn, labeled the U.S. military as terrorists. Well, one American who's had a front row seat to the tensions between the U.S. and Iran is Washington Post journalist Jason Rezaian, who spent 544 days in an Iranian prison on espionage charges. He was released a little over 3 years ago and has written a book about his experience called Prisoner. I spoke with Rezaian earlier this week at an event at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston.
So, Jason, you have been out of prison for a little more than 3 years now. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. There are still aspects of life and freedom that take some getting used to. Bright lights, lots of sounds, crowded places. But, you know, by and large, freedom is way better than prison.
You spent a lot of time in solitary confinement when
yeah,
you were in prison.
Freedom's definitely better than solitary confinement. Yeah, I spent 7 weeks at the beginning of my imprisonment in solitary. My wife and I were arrested from our homes at gunpoint, taken to Evin prison, blindfolded, handcuffed, separated, thrown into solitary. I had no news about her for the first 35 days that we were there. And solitary is designed to really make you go crazy. And it works.
One of the things you write in your book is that you realized very quickly when you were in prison that you wanted to have kids.
Yeah, you know, prison cells, and I would say specifically solitary confinement cells, are like a coffin. You are very much physically alive, but constrained. I was in a cell that was 4.5 by 8.5 feet wide. The only times I was let out was for interrogation. And so in a confined space like that, you think about your mortality and what you miss and things that you might want to do in your future. And when we first encountered each other after 5 weeks, that was the first thing she said to me. And I said, me too. You know, I really want to have a kid. So we're trying in earnest. You know?
What were you told about why you were in prison?
On the first night, I was told that I was the station chief of the Tehran CIA office and that they had plenty of proof to back it up. I'd been working as a journalist in Iran for 5 years at that point with full state permission. The week before, I'd been in Vienna covering the latest round of the nuclear negotiations between Iran and world powers. I was doing my job in the most above board and transparent way that you can imagine. So they started hurling all of these allegations that I was spying and was the architect of the sanctions regime against Iran. None of these arguments held any water, but I learned very quickly it didn't matter. The bottom line is, if you end up in prison and then put on trial and you don't have a lawyer, and the court that you're in has the word revolutionary in its name, the odds of getting a fair trial are pretty slim.
Well, actually, it made me wonder why they even bother with the trial. when it was not a fair trial at all.
I think that they want to publicly go through the machinations of a process, a judicial process, so that their international representatives, when they come to the United Nations, can say, see, we put them through a rigorous trial, and our judicial agencies are independent from the executive offices, and we have a robust and democratic society, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Do you think, though, that they really believed the things that they were saying that you did, or that they were just making it up?
The planners of my arrest and detention obviously knew that I hadn't done anything wrong. My only crime was that I worked for a high-profile American news organization and happened to be an American citizen. The people doing the interrogations, though, on some level had to believe that I was guilty of something.
What do you think that they wanted out of keeping you in prison, or what did they want for your release?
They were looking for political concessions from the very start. Iran has been taking prisoners, hostages, for 40 years and using them to extract concessions from foreign governments, most often the United States. So I see myself as unremarkable in that sense, you know, on this long continuum of U.S. hostages in Iran.
Well, and actually, one of the interesting things is your father ran a Persian rug business in the United States, and after the Iranian hostage crisis, back in the early 80s when the hostages were released, he sent rugs to the hostages.
My dad had been living in the United States for 20 years at that point. He was a U.S. citizen. He'd never seen anything like this before. So, like so many others, he decided to make a gesture. And what he did was offer each one of them $1,000 of credit in his shop. And I've been to the home of one of the former hostages just outside of D.C. three or four times. And every time I come over, he's a wonderful gentleman. And he, you know, flips over the corner of the rug where it's got my dad's label on it and says, your dad gave me this 40 years ago.
You're talking to us about this. I'm presuming that nobody in this room has spent time in an Iranian jail. I could be wrong.
You never know. There's way more of us than you think.
But is there anybody, once you're out, that you can talk to about your experience and they'll understand what you've been through?
There are. A couple of the hostages from the embassy I talked to, other journalists who've been held in Iran. David Rode, the former New York Times correspondent who was taken by the Taliban and is now an editor at The New Yorker, has been an incredible advocate and friend of mine. I spoke to him for the first time about 2 months after I was released, and it was after that conversation that I had my first decent night of sleep in freedom, because I realized that I wasn't the first person to go through this and that other people had survived.
It's also clear that it meant a great deal to you, and I think it's worth remembering it for those of us who care about journalism in this country. It meant a lot to you when people at the Washington Post remembered that you were there, brought it up every time they had a chance with an Iranian official, brought it up with American officials.
It still does. It makes it a lot easier to go back to work knowing that your colleagues, your employers, never forgot about you. I mean, the Post was incredible, but the Post as an institution has a long history of being incredibly supportive of its staff, and in the aftermath have continued to be so supportive, giving me space to recover, to write my book, and have given me the opportunity to come back to work and write about the things that, for better or worse, I know about. So I end up writing a lot about Iran and press freedom issues.
Do you think that the Obama administration did enough to get you out of prison?
So,
because you don't thank President Obama in your acknowledgments, but you do thank a lot of other people.
Did I not thank him?
No.
So, I've had the opportunity to meet President Obama a couple of times, and we've talked about all of this, and a lot of folks in his administration apologized to me for it taking so long. I think the reality is I should not have been arrested in the first place, that there might have been possibilities to bring me home earlier, but the administration decided very early on to separate out these negotiations. if the negotiations over myself and other Americans being held in Iran were taking place in the same room as the nuclear negotiations, it would have made it very difficult to get a deal. So what happened, and I recount this in the book in pretty good detail, is a separate channel of secret negotiations that were going on for 14 months. You know, there were a lot of people, opponents of the nuclear deal in 2015, who used my imprisonment and the imprisonment of other Americans in Iran as a reason why Obama should not do a deal. One of them is now our Secretary of State. These very same people, in the run-up to Trump pulling out of the nuclear deal last year, were and continue to be silent on Americans who are still imprisoned there. So I end up writing about Americans that are imprisoned in Iran all the time, because if I don't do it, I don't know who else will. And I'm thankful to the Obama administration for making my return, if not the priority, a priority.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you one more thing, which is, you are back at the Washington Post. You're still doing journalism. What did all of this make you think about the importance of the work that you were doing that got you in there in the first place and that you're still doing now?
It's made me double down, right? I worked and lived in a society that was run by authoritarians, and I wasn't able to necessarily write and say what I wanted to all the time. Now I can. And I take that privilege very seriously. I worry about the state of press freedom in this country all the time, but I think that our institutions, especially in terms of expression, are on pretty solid ground. And I'm just excited to keep pushing forward.
Jason, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Jason Rezaian of The Washington Post speaking with me earlier this week at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. Rezaian spent 544 days in an Iranian prison. His book about it is called Prisoner.
A federal court in Cincinnati has ruled against the practice of marking tires with chalk to enforce parking time limits. The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals said chalking is a form of trespassing and requires a warrant. And you might be thinking, wait, chalking became a federal case? Yes, and let's bring in the man who made it one. Philip Ellison is the Saginaw, Michigan lawyer who filed this lawsuit. And Phil, this started when a colleague was sitting on the phone with you in a car?
That's right. So my co-counsel on the case, Matt Granda, and I were chatting on the phone like we do regularly, and he was sitting outside the local courthouse, and the parking enforcement official started coming down the street with their stick and marking tires, bing, 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 and she hit his tire. Next thing you know, the question got turned around to, well, what right does she have to do that, and isn't this vandalism and Fourth Amendment, and did a little bit of research over the next couple days, and we literally then made a federal case out of chalking.
Well, it included a Facebook rant from you complaining about this. You got responses from other people and decided to take this to the courts. The first court, a lower court, throughout your lawsuit, they disagreed. They said there's something called the community caretaker exception. In other words, a community has the right to take care of their community. Maybe it's to, you know, oversee the parking. This is a part of Saginaw that doesn't have meters. So this was what they were doing to take care of their community. But do you have any sympathy for this poor law enforcement officer who was named in your suit, who's the one who walks up and down the street putting the chalk? Do you have any sympathy?
Well, of course, we never want to hit somebody that doesn't deserve it, obviously. I mean, they certainly isn't someone we're trying to take their house or anything of that nature. But the important part is that she's a government official, and government officials need to be mindful that they are there representing the people. They're not there to raise funds as much and as high as possible for the local government.
Well, your federal court decision was based on a Supreme Court decision in 2012 that restricted the ability of police to use a GPS device to track a suspect. They say that chalk is just a low-tech version of the same thing. It's a violation of somebody's rights. You have to get a warrant to get a GPS. Obviously, nobody's going to get warrants to chalk cars. But that was the legal ruling, and you argued that.
That's right. That case is called United States versus Jones, and the United States Supreme Court, Justice Scalia, wrote that when the government trespasses onto property for the purpose of extracting information, that's a search. We argued that chalking a tire is basically a low-tech tracking device.
Well, look, We know that you went on Facebook this week and you're looking for other clients. Is this going to be a new niche practice for your law firm? Have you been unfairly chalked?
Well, unfortunately, the nature of government is that when they screw up, they screw up big. And so what we're looking for is a solution for everybody rather than our courts being swamped with, you know, a zillion small cases that we can perhaps take care of this as one single class action. And we're not saying that governments can't regulate parking. They just can't do it in this particular fashion.
Are you like hanging out in the diner a lot in Saginaw? Have you heard from people?
Well, I don't know if I'm going to get invited to the Saginaw City Christmas party this year, but that's the job of a lawyer. Our job is to defend the Constitution, even when it's unpopular to do so.
That's Philip Ellison, an attorney in Saginaw, Michigan, who made his fight against tire chalking a federal case and won. Phil, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, a revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. Ember Wave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018, learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave. Control your comfort.
Well, the Coachella Music Festival just wrapped up in California, and we are going to do a special Coachella edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Joining us now is Travis Holcomb, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. Hi, Travis.
Hello, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I brought you here today for this one because you and I were both at the first weekend of Coachella. You've been many times. I had never been before. I had a great time, and we ran into each other, and I wanted you to bring today some of your favorite acts that you saw at Coachella. But first of all, it was nice to see you out there. It was a little different to see you in the middle of a huge festival in the afternoon.
It was. I mean, I'm curious, like, from your point of view, mm-hmm. what were, like, some of the things that you were expecting that sort of that were different than what you expected from your first Coachella?
Okay, I have to say, it was so organized. I couldn't believe how organized it was. The shuttles, everything was like right on time. It was, you know, you had to have these wristbands to get into this part or that part. Everything started on time. I mean, can you imagine concerts, show after show, starting exactly on time, even when it's a big name person?
Right. No, it is. I will say that it does feel like it's a very well-oiled machine when you're there. Because they're 20 years in at this point or close to it. So I feel like every year the kinks get ironed out a little bit more to the point where everything is just running exactly how you think it should run.
All right. Well, let's get to some of the ones that you wanted to talk about. And of course, the big headliner there, one of them this year, was Childish Gambino. You and I were both there at that show. This pick is called Sober.
And now that it's over, I'll never be sober. I couldn't believe, but now I'm so high.
Travis, you thought Childish was a highlight of this festival this year.
You know, just conceptually, I really liked what he did during his live show. It was just sort of a whole multimedia experience. He had a giant runway that probably extended about 200 yards into the crowd. And I was curious to see how he was going to handle incorporating some of his older stuff, like this song Sober, because it's a lot different than the psych funk stuff that he came out with the Awaken My Love album.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting also to see him do This Is America and that now famous dance that he does
right,
in the video.
Yeah, and there's a lot going on with Childish Gambino. I mean, a lot of people might know him better as Donald Glover. He used to be on Community. He's the director and star of his own show called Atlanta. He's just came out with a new short film called Guava Island, starring him and Rihanna. This is it feels kind of like music is one piece of the Donald Glover
brain.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, but what the music part is pretty special.
Absolutely. The next one that you have picked is somebody who's getting so much attention right now. She just came out with a new album. This is Lizzo, and the song is called Juice. Mirror, mirror on the wall, don't say it because I know I'm cute. Ooh, baby. Louis down to my drawers, LV all on my shoes. Ooh, baby. I be dripping so much sauce, got a bin looking like bread goo. Ooh, baby. Lit up like a crystal ball, that's cool, baby, so is you. That's how I roll. If I'm shining, everybody wanna shine. Yeah, I'm gold. I was born like this, don't even gotta try. Travis, she is just getting so much buzz right now.
She is. I mean, she has a glowing personality. She's got like an A-list star kind of personality. But she's a great rapper and she's a great singer and she kind of just does a little bit of everything. She's also a fantastic flautist. I don't know if you noticed during her live set,
she pulled out a flute
and started twerking on the stage. I didn't realize that's part of her signature thing, but I guess that's something that she does with the flute and the twerking.
You know, I saw Lin-Manuel Miranda and Missy Elliott were both tweeting praise of Lizzo's new album when it came out the other day.
That's great. And Missy Elliott is actually on the new album as well.
Okay, so maybe it was self-serving. No, just kidding, Missy Elliott. The next one that you brought us is called Pour Me Water. This is by another artist that played Coachella, Mr. Easy. Everybody want me, make I no fall in love with you. But I no answer them, I tell them, say, now you. Right now you come and then you play me for a fool. I'm out here wondering what I do, yeah. Pour me water. So I did not see Mr. Easy when I was there. Tell us more about Mr. Easy.
He had an early set on a Saturday afternoon, but I didn't really know what to expect from him. He was performing on the main stage, but he's one of the smaller names on the Coachella lineups. Mm-hmm. But he's an artist that I've been a really big fan of for the past 2 or 3 years. And he blew me out of the water with just how well composed he was. He had a full band as well as like a whole team of dancers along with him. There was probably about 12 people on stage with him. Mr. Easy is from Nigeria. I believe he's based in London, but he's sort of part of this scene called the Afrobeats scene, Afrobeats plural, which is sort of music emerging from the African diaspora, kind of adjacent to dance hall and reggae, I guess, as we heard in the song Pour Me Water.
Okay, well, I wanted to bring one to you that stood out to me. And I've been listening to a lot of music that I was hearing there from Tame Impala, from Christine and the Queens, from Anderson .Paak, from Janelle Monáe. But I would say that the band that I have just been discovering really since Coachella, since seeing them there, is Rufus Du Sol.
So what is it about Rufus Du Sol that got to you at Coachella this year?
So one of the things that I noticed about it, and I used to be a big fan, you know, and still am, but was a big fan of like Radiohead, early Coldplay, stuff like that, and these songs that would kind of do something totally different in the middle. There's one Rufus Du Sol song called Inner Bloom that's like 9 minutes long, and in the middle it just sort of stops and then restarts itself up again. And I've just found it like really interesting to listen to some of his music, and also there's a dancey beat to it, a lot of it.
Feels very anthemic also.
Yeah, I think that's right.
We'll be right back.
it gets to the kind of party atmosphere that a lot of Coachella is.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, I have to say, Travis, one of the more interesting things at that festival was not any of the acts, but was when you introduced me to your friend who is the architect of Coachella, who designs where all of the tents are going to go.
Yeah. And the weird thing was, they actually, I don't know if you noticed, but they had a contest where if you design a trash can, you can
yes,
get a free ticket
right.
to Coachella. 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, he submitted a design and won a ticket to Coachella for designing one of the trash cans. And now, 3 years later
wow.
or whatever, he is one of the architects of the Coachella Festival.
You never know where your trash can design is going to get you. Travis Holcomb, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy. If you want me.
Today, President Trump rattled off tweets of outrage at the Mueller report and later said this.
And I thought after 2 years, we'd be finished with it. No, now the House goes and starts subpoenaing. They want to know every deal I've ever done. Now, Mueller, I assume, for $35 million, checked my taxes, checked my financials, which are great, by the way. You know they're great. All you have to do is go look at the records. They're all over the place.
Let's bring in NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Hi, Phil. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Robin.
And let's start there. The Treasury ignored the deadline to turn the president's tax returns over to Congress. That claim that Mueller must have seen his tax returns. Your thoughts?
I'm not sure that he did. There's nothing in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report, which came out last week, that indicates there was any kind of examination about that specifically. Although the high-level conclusion in Volume 1 was that Mueller's investigators didn't develop evidence about a conspiracy between Trump's campaign and the Russian interference of the election, it's possible that they considered some of the other broader things that Democrats have speculated about the president, that he might have been subject to some financial influence or had some other kind of improprieties in his past mm-hmm. that Russia can use against him. But in terms of that specific right. Statement the president made, we don't have anything from this material that backs that up.
Right. And it feels as if it's a news storyline being put out, so we'll keep an eye on it. But he's also, and his backers, the president's backers, are saying move on. But the report was not written as a last word, so we're going to continue to dig at it. You say you're surprised at what isn't in it.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting aspects to this story that, even though this is a nearly 500-page document, weren't really addressed in very much detail. One example is, why did Russian leaders, as early as 2014, decide to start this big influence campaign against the United States? Whose idea was it? How did they decide which things to try to do against the United States? The social media agitation we've talked about, the theft of material from political targets, which was then released. There are also other aspects, cyber attacks against state election infrastructure and vendors and that sort of thing. But there are also things we know that the Russians tried to do which are not in this report. For example, there's a Russian woman named Maria Butina who has a sentencing hearing this week, actually on Friday, who was a part of outreach from the Russian government to Trump's campaign. Her story is not a part of this, which raises the question of what are the things the Russians might have done as part of this interference and disinformation campaign that U.S. officials know about, but what, for whatever reason, were not included in this study.
Well, you know, the president's son-in-law and advisor, Jared Kushner, is trying to poo-poo Russian interference at large. He says that it was nothing, and this is at an event yesterday hosted by Time magazine. Let's listen.
Quite frankly, the whole thing's just a big distraction for the country, and you look at you know, what Russia did, you know, buying some Facebook ads to try to sow dissent and do it. And it's a terrible thing. But I think the investigations and all of the speculation that's happened for the last 2 years has had a much harsher impact on our democracy.
Well, Phil, you talk about some of the things that are not in the report that surprised you, and they may be in redacted material. But what is, let's just be clear, what is in the report about Russian interference?
Well, there's a great deal of detail. And onto that point specifically, yes, these interference specialists at the Internet Research Agency did buy paid ads on Facebook, less than about $200,000 worth, according to the company. But they also created a great deal of content themselves. They posed as American Facebook users and created photos and memes and posts, which they shared and got other people to share. And so all told, they were able to reach millions of Americans, according to the special counsel and Facebook. So although a small, comparatively small amount of that was in these paid ad buys, there's a great deal more influence. And that doesn't include Twitter and Instagram and even things like Pokemon Go, which were also part of this interference effort in 2016.
Yeah. What about the characterization of what's in the report? Attorney General William Barr said the White House was fully cooperative. The report says emails were deleted. He was asked if Mueller didn't charge the president with obstruction because of DOJ policy against indicting a sitting president. Barr said no, that wasn't the reason. The report shows, you know, it largely was. Barr said no obstruction at all. Mueller lists possible incidents. Do you view this document as a still living, breathing thing, or as a closed book, which is what President Trump is viewing it as?
Well, there are a lot of questions, including some of the ones I posed a moment ago, that members of Congress, probably in both parties, are going to ask the Attorney General, Bill Barr, and also potentially the special counsel, Robert Mueller, when he goes to talk to Congress at some point in the future. No hearing is scheduled yet with Mueller, but the Justice Department, through Barr, has said that it probably has no problem with him appearing at some point. It's probably not a closed book because, for one thing, Republicans want an investigation into this investigation. The chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Lindsey Graham, wants to know about the investigators' use of foreign surveillance and confidential informants and other spy tools, if you will, early on in 2016. And Democrats have a lot of questions about the responses given by the president and others. And they also think that this compels the Congress to do something. For Democrats, especially Volume 2 of this study includes evidence of what they call really inappropriate behavior by the president, and they're split among themselves about what to do about that. And so this is not a closed book. We're not through with this chapter quite yet.
NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.